Right now it's midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Thomas Allen is one of the world's finest lyric baritones. A beautiful voice and a real ability to act have made him a dream Don Giovanni, Count Almaviva and Billy Budd. He's now also a director, and Tom was knighted in 1999.
You come from mining country, don't you?
Yes. I mean, you know, they didn't exactly shout down the shaft and get me to come up.
No.
But surrounded very heavily by mines. Yes, in fact, we were hemmed in right on the seashore, and the mines stretched out under the sea as well. So yes, it's very much in my blood.
And when did music first sort of? When did you sort of think to yourself, actually, this is what I want to do with my life?
Oh, I didn't actually become aware of that aspect of, or that possibility. Until relatively late on. I mean, I was probably already a student at the Royal College of Music, wondering, you know, what the next day was going to lead to. I really didn't know. It was all a voyage of discovery for about, I would say, the first 2.5 years when I was there. And then it began to make a certain amount of sense, and I got an ARCM, and then I got an extra year.
What did you start off studying then?
I started off studying singing with that intention, but I just didn't know the extent to which one could have a career. You know, I was discovering opera. I'd seen 2 or 3 operas by then in the Northeast, but I was finding out about it a little bit. I was more interested in oratorio and songs. I was always, right from the start, I was always able to stand up and sing a song when I was a little boy within the family. You know, like a lot of entertainers, I think otherwise I was quite shy and receding. But music was there, and church choirs were there. My father played the piano a lot at home, and I listened to him imitating Charlie Kuntz and heard popular songs and some oratorios, mostly Stainer and Maunder, but occasionally Haydn and Handel. And so it went on from there. But opera came, you know, at a sort of at a later stage, really.
Your first music is actually orchestral, but only because it's an overture.
It's Humperdinck. I love this piece. We're talking about Hansel and Gretel. I've been familiar with some of the music of Hansel and Gretel since I was in the junior school. We used to sing, "With your foot you tap, 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 with your hands you clap." And I remember that very distinctly without knowing what I was singing about or who they were. But the orchestration of this overture and of the piece in general by Humperdinck, it makes me smile. Mm-hmm. It makes such a warm glow with inside you. There's a wonderful contentment. The story itself is grisly in many ways, but the glory of the music is there, and I smile every time I hear it come on. It just gives me such pleasure.
I remember the first time I heard that, I thought, but this sounds quite like Wagner.
Yes. Would that he could... He shouldn't say this, it's sacrilege, but would that he could be so succinct. it's full of wonderful melody. I mean, the tunes keep on coming. There's an adult tune, then there's a tune for children, there's a sort of little military march in there that's probably tin or chocolate soldiers or wooden soldiers. It's full of wonderful invention.
And you could tell that Colin Davis was relishing it there, couldn't you?
I think so. I mean, I can imagine Colin with a stick quite low, just, yeah, you know, churning it out, which is his habit.
The Dresden Staatskapelle Orchestra were conducted by Sir Colin Davis in the overture to Humperdinck's Hansel and Gretel. Do you find that when you know you're going to be singing a certain opera with a certain cast, that finding out who the conductor is a pretty important moment?
That's a very interesting question. Usually when I find out that I'm going to be singing an opera in a certain place, I've no idea who the cast is. A case in point, I'm due to be in Cincinnati shortly to take part in some performances of Meistersinger, and it was to be James Levine who was withdrawn, and I might find out who that is and who replaces him, but it could be quite a surprise when I get there. It often is the case, especially in places like Vienna, where there's a kind of factory belt of performances going on, and night by night by night there are different people.
Well, the other thing that I'm sure that people listening to the programme may not realise is how often people walk onto the stage of these major houses, especially if they're filling in for someone, not having rehearsed really hardly at all.
Oh, no, that's very common. Yeah. Very common. I mean, I've spoken to people who, you know, tell me that they're thrilled to be going to Vienna and to the Staatsoper. And I say, all right, when, what are you going to see? And they'll tell you, and you think, well, I know for a fact that the cast will be getting about 3/4 of an hour rehearsal for that. There are some very interesting mathematical equations to be made here, or problems to be sorted here. I remember one of the things I did in Vienna, I sang a lot in Vienna at one time, on one occasion, Traviata. And I had, the rehearsal was set aside with Edita Gruberova, who was to sing the Violetta the following night, incidentally. So it's only the day before. So we had 25 minutes to do our scene, and our scene only. When it came to the evening, it was, you know, left to your own devices and logic as to there's a door, you go through it, you say the appropriate things to the appropriate people, and you leave at the appropriate time. I had no idea what was going on. But the worst one was when I was in the middle of the second act of Bohème. It was a second performance, and, you know, Marcello in the second act proposes the toast, and l'allegri un toast, quale liquore, and everyone joins in. And that's the cue for Marcello's lover, Musetta, to laugh off stage before she makes her frivolous entry. And so the lady in question laughed off stage, and I thought to myself, I've no idea who that is, because I don't recognise the voice. Not at all. And a girl walked on stage I'd never seen before in my life, and we just made it up as we went along. And for that, you pay lots of money. But the strange thing is, it often works. That's the exciting thing.
Yeah, yes. The interesting thing is that with this programme, as you know, we don't usually have professional musicians, so it's rather nice that we're having a group at the moment, because what people normally do is to reveal a love of music, which they're not known for because they're either a painter or something. Mm. But in this interest, what we'll find out, things that you love which you don't necessarily sing, and our next piece, of course, is a very good example.
It is. I've chosen some Schubert, some piano music. If I come home from work, I don't immediately put music on anyhow. And if I do, it's more likely to be something other than the human voice. My wife knows, Jeannie knows, that when I come in at night, she often is listening to Radio 3, which she'll be pleased to hear, or recordings. And if I walk through the door, she tends then to turn to Radio 4 and the Archers or whatever, rather than inflict yet another voice on me. I just need to get away from it. I'm sure I'm not unusual in that. But if I want to listen to some music, then I love listening to piano music. There are one or two colleagues of mine with whom I've dared to play the piano on occasions, and they're quite amused at that, more than quite amused. It makes them hysterical, really, playing piano duets. But I enjoy it. I love it. I can't deny that. And I only wish I could achieve some kind of expertise at it. It's too long now. I've been playing badly too long to do that. But I've chosen this Fantasia because I don't want to hear a Schubert song, but the melody in this and the bareness at times in it, I think, is rather wonderful. I think with four hands, and this is Brendel and Evelyn Crochet playing the Fantasy of the Opus 103 F minor, because there are four hands, you can sort of analyse it as it goes along, and it's easy somehow to differentiate what is going on and then put it all together, and there's a clarity within it and a energy within it and a beauty and invention that gives me huge satisfaction.
Thank you.
I don't know how many programmes you've done, but it must have cropped up on many occasions.
It's come occasionally, yes.
And there's good reason, because it's such a beautiful piece. I mean, the shape of it is beautiful. But from my point of view, this applies to the Hansel and Gretel as well. I think it makes me feel as if I really do live on an island. And this is a contact with a completely different part of Europe where music like this was invented and where it developed and where it's really at home. And when I'm in Munich, which I am a lot, or in Vienna or around Vienna in Austria, and driving around and looking at a linden tree that inspired Schubert or whatever it might be, it just is an insight into something else that was going on there. And it is an insight, I think, into that. And it's a privilege. That's part of the privilege, I think, of having the colleagues there and being a part of this music making that sits slightly unnaturally with us still, I think, here at times.
Alfred Brendel and Evelyn Crochet were playing part of the Fantasia in F minor, Deutsch 940, by Schubert. Tom Allen, we've talked a little bit about casts and conductors, and I suppose the next thing is directors. I mean, you've actually appeared under the hand, as it were, of some completely contrasting characters, haven't you? I mean, Woody Allen.
Contrasting characters by way of directors, from Woody Allen all the way to Giorgio Strehler and beyond. Yeah, they come in all shapes and sizes.
I mean, do they make the same kind of difference that a conductor makes, or do they make an even bigger difference, do you think?
There is no set rule for that, and I don't know what the set rule is either for a conductor. In the case of directors, I'm learning this myself, that so much of the job is in their own choice of designer. The designer will come up with ideas, and I mean, it's a discussion, obviously, but the designer is the person, the artist who can actually put the bricks and mortar together of a set on the stage.
Because period is one of the first decisions, isn't it? Where are we going to set this opera?
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Well, like yesterday, I made a decision 1790 for Figaro, for example, so we know where we are with that. That's looming large for me at the moment. And it can be very telling, and that's down to your designer. And so many of the answers as to what a director does are provided by the designer. But there are those other directors who, I mean, you go from the full concept, Gesamtwerk and everything else, you know, Durchkomponiert, all of those big, big German compound words apply, who've thought the entire thing through from the first clarinet entry in the orchestra right the way to the final chord and everything else that goes on in between. And that's quite stifling, I find. And then there are the others that, the rare ones, really. Well, no, not so rare, I suppose. I think it's as well to understand that we do have usually a very good relationship, and there's a give and take, and it's an exchange of ideas, largely, in the best of circumstances, I always feel. And I think the best of directors are looking at the individual that's up there on the stage, hoping to interpret their idea and their vision of what they've had for the last 2-3 years in preparing this piece, looking at the individual and then being able to tailor it. Peter Hall was always very good at that, it seems to me, that he wouldn't come with preset ideas, although there would be largely formed ones and mature ones, but with scope to mould an individual into what his idea might be of a piece. And that was the case with Giovanni at Glyndebourne, I think, when I went into it. And then others that simply don't really know. And we'll say, I like the picture made over there a moment ago. Do you think you could remember what that was? And I think, you know, when you go over there, could you maybe... All right, okay. Could we repeat that? And it goes...
No prizes for guessing who that was.
It goes right to great extremes. And then Strehler, who was a genius stroke monster... I loved Giorgio Strehler. It was hugely physical. We had fights. I mean, it was only a matter of time before we punched one another, I think. But we got a result in the end. I wish I'd known him when he was a younger man, and hugely vital. He was still vital when I worked with him. But there were probably greater years before that, and he was a giant on the world stage.
Beckmesser was a very important role for you, wasn't it?
It was hugely important, and very much a surprise. I remember looking at a score of Meistersinger when I was a young man at Covent Garden, thinking, I understand that there's a very large role in this piece. And I was thinking of, you know, Hans Sachs, obviously, and wondering why it was so large and what it was about the piece. And I'm very bad about going to the opera. Outside of the performances of Meistersinger, in which I've sung, I've seen it on 1.5 other occasions. That's shocking, I know, but it is true. So further down the line, having put this score away, Peter Kattner, who does a lot of the hiring and firing at Covent Garden and the artistic sculpturing, if you like.
Very, very good casting voices.
Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. The sort of quiet genius behind everything there, and has been for many years, said to me, "How do you feel about Beckmesser?" And I didn't know how I felt about Beckmesser, or I wouldn't have done, if a German colleague of mine in Munich, Alfred, 2 or 3 weeks earlier, hadn't said, "Du musst Beckmesser lernen." And he gave me a little yellow book with all the text in it. Not that that was any good, because it's an immense musical role. So two people saying this almost simultaneously made me think, well, perhaps I should. And so it began, and we put on this production at Covent Garden that was still perhaps the most memorable evening of my life, and for many others too, I think.
You've decided, interestingly enough, to hear once again part of the music without the voices.
There's enormous involvement in the vocal areas of Meistersinger, and it is many hours long. But there comes a point after the, to quote from Peter Grimes, after the hurly-burly of the second act, that we just allow ourselves to calm down a little bit, and the third act opens in a completely different vein, and it's Hans Sachs contemplating everything that he's just witnessed and everything that has happened and the potential danger of it all, and seeking to find some kind of calm in all of that. And there he is in his study, preceded by this amazing music.
There's something about the kind of inevitability of Wagner, isn't there, in that music? The kind of breath in it.
Yes.
The long breaths and that just make you become hypnotised.
It's incredibly seductive, I think. I think once it entrances you in that way, I think you can't get out of its clutches somehow. I mean, listening to that again, how Kubelik sustains that slow, and he takes a very slow tempo deliberately to see it through. And it's daring, it's very daring to keep it all together, to keep the architecture of that together. And I think that's what Bernhard Haitink was so good at, that from the very first moment to the end, 5 or whatever hours later, you had this tremendous span, this bridge that... of which he understood the architecture and could make that span work.
And also, I was thinking, for people like you, Tom Allen, standing in the wings, not necessarily at that moment, but you know, in moments like that, to hear that sound coming from the orchestra, it must be incredibly inspiring when you're about to go out.
Well, it is.
And be part of it.
It is. I mean, it's happened with Mozart in particular, I think, and with Puccini and with Verdi. But when it comes to this fellow, Richard Wagner, I... look at my colleagues that spend their lives there, you know, those that have sung many Wagner roles, and I think they've had extraordinary lives, because it's as though their hearts beat at a different rate. They live at a different rate from the rest of us. They are different kind of people from the rest of us. I think it's not the healthiest area to inhabit for every singer, obviously, because it can take its toll. But this is important to me, this particular piece. Peace. I'm going to call it a piece. We're talking about Meistersinger of Nuremberg. Because it was a very significant time for me at Covent Garden, and I think for everybody else. And the extraordinary thing was that in the way that it developed, quietly with a semicircle of chairs, with the Meisters sat there day after day, making our various interjections and commentary on what was going on, and making it as real as possible, and discussing all of that, and then it all coming together. The days would go by, the weeks would then go by, and then from that rehearsal room to go to the stage, you knew there was a buzz happening, and I've talked about this in the past, and I'm not deceiving myself, it really did exist. Then there were people wandering around in the theatre thinking, hello, there's something big happening here. And then the first night, the dress rehearsal in the first night was immensely exciting. It was a huge success. And when we got to the Festwiese at the end of the third act, by the time you make this wonderful procession to the Songfest itself, you looked out into the audience, and the whole of the audience were part of that festival. The first time and only time, I think, I felt being at Covent Garden actually incorporated the whole area. It was all... The whole theatre was the arena in which we were performing, not just on the stage. It involved everyone. And that was amazing. An amazing experience.
The prelude to Act 3 of Die Meistersinger von Nuremberg by Wagner. We heard, as Tom Allen said, the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra conducted by Raphael Kubelik. Now, you're a boy of the sea, and I'm not now talking about Billy Budd, although I think, yeah.
No, I was born by the sea and lived by the sea for the first 18 or 19 years of my life, and once that's happened to you, once that's in your blood, it's difficult to get away from it. I think there are mountain people and plains people and desert people. I'm a sea person. I get sick at sea, I have to say, but I just love being close to the sea. It makes me feel better. I remember a doctor saying it's because of the interface. It's the positive and negative ions interfacing with one another, whatever that means. I genuinely do feel the benefit of it, and I like to have it in my life, and that's why this piece comes up.
Well, interestingly, you've chosen not Benjamin Britten, but his teacher, Frank Bridge.
Well, in recitals, I often find myself singing Bridge songs, and I introduce them and say, usually, I want to sing now some songs by Frank Bridge, whose other name is Frank Bridge, teacher of Benjamin Britten. I mean, you almost can't get rid of that little addendum on the end. And then the orchestral music, which we need to hear more and more of, I think, and the chamber music too.
This is the second part you've chosen of the scene.
Yes. Yeah. Well, because it's slightly more relaxed. I'm staying away from too hectic a music, it seems, at the moment. This is Moonlight from the Sea by Frank Bridge.
Thank you.
Well, he had the ability to spin a long line there,
absolutely,
didn't he?
Mm. One or two things occur to me. It's that he's not well enough known for us to sit down and say, well, that's clearly bridge. Mm. We don't recognise his voice sufficiently well, I think, and I think that's a great pity. And he's sort of an amalgam of French music that was going on, Impressionism and everything else. And but you can hear the English strains as well that are, you know, part and parcel of English music of that period, I think.
But what you can say straight away is that that is a very beautiful piece of music by any standard.
It's ravishing.
Yes.
Ravishing. And I'm there on the beach, and I can see the moonlight.
Music from the Sea by Frank Bridge. And we heard the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Charles Groves. So, Tom, now that you've moved into directing a certain amount, do you find it quite fascinating to see from the other side, as it were? I mean, has it informed you in a way?
Oh, hugely, yeah. I mean, it's a big learning process. There's no guarantee, having been a singer for 40 years or whatever, that you learn the other sides of the business. You know, the days that we have off as singers between dress rehearsals and first nights, or, you know, when the day comes to an end at 5:30 or 6 or whatever it might be, all the technical stuff that then goes on that we run away from. It's not our domain, it's the domain of other people. And as a singer, you've finished for the day and you go. But I wouldn't say that I've had to learn all about that, but I've learned a little bit about that. I leave the lighting, obviously, to a man or a woman who knows what that is about. But I love being part of that process. It's a creative process rather than a recreative process. And I think many years ago, that's why I wanted to write a book as well, to be an originator of something rather than just a re-perpetrator of stuff that had gone on before. I mean, I've sort of had discussions about that in the past with various people, but there's a sort of frustration there, I think, that one wasn't producing original work.
We're going to finish, Tom Allen, with the first composer of opera, more or less,
yeah,
and one of the greatest, too.
Yes. Yeah, well, it would probably come as a surprise to people, my interest in Monteverdi. I've never actually sung any Monteverdi in this country. That's not a hint or anything of the sort. It's just a fact. But for quite a number of years, I've enjoyed singing the role of Ulysses in The Return of Ulysses of Monteverdi, in various guises, in various musical interpretations. I saw it first at Glyndebourne. I loved it. There was something quite clearly, intrinsically profound about the piece and genuine and truthful about the piece, which I liked to watch. I then had the opportunity of singing it first in Salzburg in 1985. And this really is a conglomeration of various things, because it was an opportunity to sing the role. Salzburg decided that they wanted to do this, and of course there were the Arnoncourt, famous versions by Arnoncourt and by Raymond Lepard and at Glyndebourne and various others. And I think powers that be, or someone or other along the line, decided, well, we'd need to take a different view of this and come up with a completely different version of what this music is about. And of course the purists hated it when Hans-Werner Henze produced what he did. Those of us involved in it absolutely loved it, because it produced sounds the like of which I think we'd never dealt with before in the percussion department, or rather in the, you know, the kitchen sink department. There was an instrument, I think, called a lujon, and we had electric guitar.
More familiar to composers like me than the Monteverdi.
They haven't been used terribly often, but there it was, and several others, and electric guitars and mandolins and bouzoukis. So the bouzouki was important. We had no higher instrument, I think, than a viola da gamba. Or maybe a viola, I forget. And so consequently what you got was this low, deep music, this deep in intent and deep in its density, really. And it felt pre-Christian. I think that's what I felt about it. Mm. That there was no somehow Christian enlightenment in it. It did belong to an earlier age than that, the music that he produced. And I loved doing it. And we did this in Salzburg, and this is the last scene, I think, we're going to hear.
Well, and it gives us the opportunity, finally, to hear not only your voice speaking, but singing.
Oh, God.
Servo
felt as though I was on holiday on a Greek island there for a moment with all the plinkety-plonk and then the accordion music coming in. It's odd to listen to it now. We thought, you know, it was wonderful at the time. I think it still is immensely inventive in making it up. I'd much prefer it in a barer state than that now, and the ones that I'm more accustomed to singing are much barer than that. There was a production we did in Los Angeles that I think the sum total of instruments was 8, maybe, and 3 of those were recorders that barely registered. But nevertheless, this has a grandiosity to it that is very, very interesting, I think.
That was Hans Werner Henze's arrangement of Monteverdi's Il Ritorno d'Ulisse. And my guest, Thomas Allen, was singing Ulysses, Kathleen Kuhlmann, Penelope, with the Vienna Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Geoffrey Tate. Well, Tom, thank you for lending us your voice as both speaker and singer today and introducing us to these pieces that have a special significance for you.
Thanks very much, Michael. I've really enjoyed it. It means a lot to me.
Thomas Allen was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week, Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions will be Dame Barbara Stocking, chief executive of the charity Oxfam. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's edition was Chris Marshall. Well, on Night Waves, tomorrow night, Matthew Sweet hosts a discussion about Harper Lee's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, To Kill a Mockingbird. Since its publication 50 years ago, it's sold more than 30 million copies in 18 languages and is a set text in schools around the world. The novelist Andrew O'Hagan, the former Lord Chancellor Charles Falconer, and the anthropologist Kit Davis join Matthew to discuss the enduring significance of Harper Lee's only novel. Also, Matthew talks to the actor Simon Callow about his autobiography, My Life in Pieces. Simon Callow's on tour at the moment with his one-man show Shakespeare, The Man from Stratford, and he discusses the actors and productions that have shaped him as a performer. And the New York internet guru Clay Shirky joins Matthew to put the case for what he describes as cognitive surplus, the surfeit of intellect, energy and time that the Western world has enjoyed since the Second World War. Today's digital technology, he argues, is taking us away from the passive consumption of television and returning us to a collaboration and social activity which were natural until the 1900s. That's all on Night Waves tomorrow night with Matthew Sweet at 9:15. Here on BBC Radio 3.
I know I'm going to die soon, but I'm going to die in a very good mental state.
The historian Tony Judt talks about the illness that's paralysed everything but his mind.
I have motor neuron disease. You can't cure it, you can't fix it, you can't stop it, but you've got one thing over it. It doesn't hurt. You don't need medicine, you just need a mind.
No triumph, no tragedy. Tuesday morning at 9, over on BBC Radio 4.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's just gone 1 o'clock. Time for the news, read by David Cornett.
The Unite Union has said it's postponing a ballot of British Airways cabin crew so that it can consider a new offer on pay and conditions that was put forward by the airline last week. The dispute has caused 22 days of strike action so far this year and cost BA more than £150 million. The latest offer includes a guarantee that basic salaries will rise over 2 years. Unite's joint leader Tony Woodley said he couldn't recommend the offer because the airline was refusing to reinstate travel concessions to staff who went on strike. BA said the offer was fair and reasonable. The Work and Pension Secretary Ian Duncan Smith has said he wants to offer unemployed people incentives to leave their council homes and to relocate to areas where there are better job prospects. He says too many people have become trapped because they don't want to leave an area for fear that they may lose their homes. The Shadow Education Secretary and Labour leadership candidate Ed Balls says the policy is deeply unfair. Securing global financial stability will top the agenda at the G20 summit in Canada. But there are tensions as some European countries, including the UK, want to cut state spending, which the US says could jeopardise economic recovery. England has a fully fit team for this afternoon's World Cup second round match against Germany. It's the first time the two sides have met in the tournament since Italia 90, when their semi-final went to penalties. Germany have never lost a shootout in the tournament. China's leading contemporary artist, Wu Guangzhong, has died. He was 90. In 1992, he became the first living Chinese artist to have his paintings exhibited at the British Museum. Wu Guangzhong's trademark Chinese landscapes combined delicate Eastern ink techniques with Western oil painting methods. And the weather, it'll be the hottest day of the year so far across southern parts, with temperatures reaching 30 Celsius in the London area and the mid to high 20s elsewhere in the south. There'll be some warm sunshine further north, but scattered showers across Scotland and Northern Ireland. BBC News and Weather at approaching 3 minutes past one.
And it was read by David Cornett. Well, now it's time here on Radio 3 for the Early Music Show, presented by Catherine Bott.
The otherworldly sound of Alessandro Moreschi, the last castrato, on a very scratchy-sounding recording made in Rome more than a century ago. It's not a sound we're familiar with these days, of course, as the practice of carrying out surgical procedures on young boys in order to preserve their angelic voices has, I'm delighted to say, long since died out. There are still plenty of male singers who cherish and perform the music written for castrati, though, and we'll be hearing from some of them throughout today's programme, which is dedicated to boys who sing high. Names like Farinelli and Senesino crop up on the early music show all the time, but this year marks the 200th anniversary of the death of an equally renowned singer from the next generation, Venanzio Rauzzini. Rauzzini's career took him to royal courts, opera stages and concert platforms all over Europe, but he spent the last 30 years of his life in southwest England, here in the city of Bath. He became an integral part of Bath's musical and social life in the late 18th century, and the city is still rightly proud of his achievements, so much so that the Bath Philharmonia held a memorial concert at the Abbey in April to mark his anniversary. The concert included arias which were written especially for Rauzzini, and the star of the show that evening was the Moldovan male soprano Radu Marian, here performing this charming little ditty by Albinoni.
Non la spero e non la vedo, no,
Nulla spero e nulla bramo. I expect nothing and I desire nothing. An aria from Albinoni's pastoral serenata, Il Nascimento dell'Aurora. It was performed there by the Klemencic consort, and the role of Zefiro was sung by the male soprano Radu Marian, who gave a concert here in Bath Abbey earlier this year. Quite an astonishing sound.